Thanks for joining me today, Ryan Campbell of Fair Vote Canada. Maybe you can just introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about what Fair Vote does.
So, like you said, my name is Ryan. I'm actually a part-time student at SFU, and I'm also engineer. I work full-time in construction as an engineer. I've been involved with Fair Vote Canada since around 2011, 2012. And Fair Vote Canada, we're a national campaign dedicated to adopting proportional representation for all levels of government across Canada.
Right. Pretty much all provinces, territories, and the federal government use the first-past-the-post system. Maybe you can just very briefly explain what that is for folks.
So first-past-the-post, it can refer to a few systems, but normally what we talk about in Canada is you have a single winner in a riding. So there's only one MP or MLA per riding, and you just mark an X next to whoever you like, and whoever gets the most votes wins. It has a few problems. One is that you can have a situation where a party or a group of candidates or whatever gets a majority of the seats without getting the majority of the vote. And you can get, there's been examples of 10, 12% of the vote. I think 13% in Quebec recently, where you get no seats at all. So it leaves large segments of the population unrepresented. Not even necessarily the usual suspects, not just small parties, but like urban conservatives, rural progressives, people like that.
What are the shortcomings of the first-past-the-post system?
Well, I may have jumped the gun a little there, but yeah, I think really it doesn't reflect how people voted. And one MP or MLA, it's hard for them to really reflect the diversity of their riding. We're an increasingly diverse country, not just, you know, in any one aspect, but especially politically. And the minority groups don't get represented. Now, a lot of MPs and MLAs will say, well, I represent everyone in my riding. But the reality is when it comes to their vote in the legislature, which is, you know, what makes us a democracy, you can't vote for and against a budget. You can't vote for and against a particular piece of legislation. So it just fails to represent about half of voters.
Right. So, I mean, first past the post, the current system used here in almost everywhere in Canada, is not actually used very much in other democratic countries. The UK uses it, the US uses it, but not many others. So it's been a constant sort of discussion around this topic from groups like Fair Vote about the importance or the need for change. What makes the status quo so sticky?
Well, I think we have a saying, especially this time of year, that turkeys don't want to vote for Thanksgiving. I think that's a problem that, you know, there's winners and losers among politicians with proportional representation, not necessarily among voters. You know, certain politicians, if you come from an area that's very heavily electing representatives from one party, suddenly under proportional representation, your party goes from having for example, Liberals in Toronto having literally all the seats with half the vote, suddenly, you know, you might be getting 55% of the seats, 60% of the seats. That presents a risk to you. So there's that issue. And the reality is that people have an interest in the system that elected them, unfortunately. So parties will look at proportional representation as great when they're in opposition, and then they kind of lose enthusiasm the longer they're in government, unfortunately. That's one problem. I think the other is that we're not taught about this in schools. Like the civics education doesn't cover the voting system. In fact, the way I was taught, and this was a while ago, actually teaches wrong information about the voting system. You know, you have your model parliament in class and everyone gets to be an MP. Well, that kind of is the logic of proportional representation where, you know, not everyone gets to be an MP, but everyone or most people, you know, in New Zealand, say 95% of people get someone they voted for as an MP. And that's not true under first past the post. It's like 50%. Right. So we're actually we're not teaching this to people. So I think there's an awareness issue. I think people kind of feel the effects of it, though, that they don't feel very satisfied with the results necessarily. But there isn't a connection made between the voting system and the problems that people see just because of that education. And fair enough, right? Like people have only so much time. They're not going to go out of their way to read chapters and chapters about the minutiae of voting systems.
So you mentioned we've sort of touched on proportional representation, but what are the alternatives or alternatives that Fair Vote advocates for?
So we advocate specifically for proportional representation, and that could take a number of approaches. There's mixed member proportional, there's single transferable vote, there's list systems. There's a lot of technical terms I could go into for each one. I think the simplest one to explain would be a list system. So you might have four members in a riding instead of one. Maybe it's less in a rural area, maybe it's more in an urban area. And you get a quarter of the vote, you get one seat, whether you're a party or an independent. If you get half the vote, you get two seats, three quarters of the vote, three seats, and so on. And that's pretty simple to understand, I think. You also can have what's called an open list, where you actually vote for a candidate rather than a party. So the people that fill those seats are also directly accountable to voters. But there's a lot of ways you can do this. You can, it really, what we're focused on is the principle that people should get what they voted for.
So I mean, you've mentioned some of the benefits and advantages. Are there disadvantages?
I don't feel there are, at least if you use reasonable forms of proportional representation that keep the number of MPs elected at one time at a reasonable level, and that keep a direct connection between voters and representatives. You have that direct link that if you don't like someone, you can just not vote for them. I think there's very few drawbacks for people. There's a lot of evidence that there's better healthcare policy, better environmental policy, stronger economic growth, better trade policy. All these things are connected to proportional representation because the incentives are different for the politicians. But it's the politicians, those are the, and a few connected, you know, lobbyists that want to lobby just one party rather than maybe multiple parties in a coalition. They're the ones that have the most to lose. Unfortunately, they're in a position of influence to decide to keep the status quo as well.
Right. You know, in some countries working with a proportional representation system, there can be a sort of tendency for fringe parties to sometimes gain outsized influence in the system just because they're needed to form a coalition. Are there ways to protect against that?
Yeah, one is you have what's called a threshold, and so you might need a certain number of votes, like say 5% of the vote or 3% of the vote to gain seats. Others, just you keep the riding sizes or region sizes smaller. So like my example of a 4-seat riding, you need about a quarter, actually in practice more like a sixth of the vote to be likely to take a seat. That's still a big chunk of the votes, and that limits the number of parties you get. Yeah. But I think the other thing that you can always do in any of these systems is the big parties can work together if there's a small party making outrageous demands or demands that aren't reflective of the majority. And we had an example of that at BC. The BC NDP wanted to proceed with liquefied natural gas development. Mm-hmm. And whether you think that's good or bad, the Greens didn't want to support that. And what they did is they made an agreement with the BC Liberals to get the legislation passed. So, you know, this concern about outsized influence of a small party, and frankly, the Greens weren't that small. They got, I think, 18% of the vote. That's pretty significant. Mm-hmm. But that's how the system, you know, whether you agree with that policy or not, from a democratic standpoint, that's how it should work, is that the major parties should be able to cooperate when they have common ground. And that's, you know, you see that in countries like Germany right now, for example. I think Denmark is doing that right now, too. Yeah.
So FairVote recently has done a study of attitudes in BC on voting reform and possible alternatives. What did you hear from that?
Well, it was actually, if this is the there was a committee of the legislature that asked people to submit their views on the voting system, whether you're for proportional representation or against. About a little under 1,000 responded. In some way, but about 850 addressed actually the voting system specifically. Right. And of those 850, about 800, 93% said they want proportional representation. Another 5% said they want the existing single member ridings with a ranked ballot, which we don't think really solves fundamental problems here. We've used that in the past and scrapped it. And then another 2% wanted to keep first past the post. So pretty overwhelming support there. And it's a fairly significant number of responses. So there is an appetite in certain quarters for reform.
So what kind of things were, because it was individuals and also organizations participating in this process, yeah?
Yeah, so of those 850, I think 46 were organizations, and I think 43 supported proportional representation specifically. And that's, you know, it could be not-for-profits like ourselves. Yeah. It could be charities. It could be unions, for example. Quite a few responded to this.
What were people in groups saying in terms of why they were supporting proportional representation?
Well, I think everyone has their own reasons, potentially. Like, you might see it for a pragmatic reason, like I want better environmental policy or I want better labor policy. But I think the one that most people find the most compelling is just fairness, right? That it shouldn't matter where you live to how effective your vote is, right? If you are in northern BC and you support the NDP, it's very unlikely you will get your vote count towards electing someone. And just like if you're in Vancouver and you support the Conservatives, you're very unlikely to have your vote count towards electing a Conservative, right? Only one out of 12, even though Conservatives got a third of the vote in Vancouver. So that kind of fairness, I think, is the most compelling kind of emotionally engaging argument, but there's pragmatic reasons as well.
So BC has voted three times, I think, on around this issue in recent decades, with various different results, but never quite enough to actually meet to get the change. Although I think the very first one did in fact come up as a majority, just not the 60% threshold. Why do you think that is? Why do you think there seems to be a lot of support. There seems to be a lot of arguments before it, but what's happening when this issue comes up towards a vote?
I think one issue is referendums aren't a good way to decide minority rights. And this is about minority rights. You know, all these groups, urban conservatives, rural progressives, Greens, these are minority groups. Yeah. And you don't really have the opportunity to kind of bargain and advance these minority groups' interests in a way that's fair in a referendum. I think that education issue I talked about earlier plays into it. We've got polls both nationally and in a couple of places, not specifically BC, but the national one I think is reflective, that about 40% of people think that the current system is proportional. So it's hard to, you know, make an argument for proportional representation when people think it's the status quo, that's how this works. And again, you know, it's not anyone's, you know, fault for this, except that we're not teaching this, right? And people are not, you know, naturally drawn to go to like Wikipedia and read like 10 pages on voting systems. I think those are big issues for referendums. It's actually really a recent thing, this idea of a referendum on electoral reform. All other cases, like, because we've had a lot of electoral reform in Canada. We brought in the secret ballot in the 1870s. That was pretty important. Things like independent redistricting, the charter, which Section 3 of the Charter, universal suffrage, none of these things were done by referendum, with one exception, which is BC had a referendum on whether or not women should be allowed to vote. And that thankfully passed. But all other provinces just had a vote of the legislature. And a country that also had votes on referendums on whether or not women could vote is Switzerland. And that failed up to the 1950s and didn't pass until the 1970s. So you can see, you know, there's this gap of like 50 years between our trajectory and Switzerland on democratic progress. And I think most people would agree that was progress because they insisted on referendums here. I think there's also issues with the lack of accountability, too, that if, you know, politicians can say they support electoral reform, but not actually do anything to support a referendum, whereas a vote of the legislature, yes or no, is much more direct. If you want this policy, you know if your representative voted yes or no in a vote of the legislature. You don't necessarily know what they did in a referendum.
Where do you want to see this process or this issue going from here? What would you like to see happen now?
Well, what I'd like to see is proportional representation adopted. You know, they created this process, so they should, you know, if they're going to have this process, they should respect kind of the feedback they got. They chose it. But other things they could do, there's, you know, another new citizens assembly, I think, would be productive. The BC Liberals have actually promised that in the previous referendum and then reneged on the promise immediately once the results were known. And the other is the Conservative vice chair of the committee talked about having municipal electoral reform, you know, try some of these systems out potentially at a municipal level first and give at least municipalities the option to take these systems, I think that would be very productive too.
You're an SFU student, and you've been involved with Fair Vote, I think you said, for more than 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this so important to you?
You know, I that's a hard question. I think I was radicalized as a student in my first undergraduate degree that I thought in our student elections that I had a student union at one level that used proportional representation. Yeah. And then I had at another level that used first past the post, and you got much more adversarial politics in first past the post than you did in the proportional system, and less reflective of the students. So, you know, student elections have pretty low turnout. I don't know how reflective you're going to get in general. And it just, the more I dug into it, the more it made sense to me. Like, I think the arguments for proportional representation are really the same as the arguments for democracy itself, that the voters aren't going to be right 100% of the time, but they're more likely to be right than having, you know, like some kind of distortion of that. And you see in like BC, you know, the 1996 election where the BC Liberals got more votes than the NDP, but the NDP formed a majority government thanks to just the vagaries of where the election boundaries are. I was pretty young for that one, but I remember it distinctly, and that bothered me. And then the next election, NDP got almost wiped out, and the Liberals got almost every seat. It really was formative that this is not working really for anyone.
Right.
And I'd add to that too. Like, I think one thing is I feel, just as a voter and an activist, I make too many compromises when I go to the ballot box, and I would like to be better able to express what I want in a more honest and nuanced way.
Right. Thanks so much for speaking to me today. Ryan Campbell is a representative for Fair Vote Canada and an SFU student. Thanks so much for talking to me today, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. On the evening of Tuesday, May 5th, in Prince George, Claydeley-Tanay, and as it turns out, in a large range around our latitude across Western Canada, many people witnessed a bizarre phenomena in the sky, somehow blurry, somehow bright, somehow moving. Was it a space ghost? A UFO? A UAV? A smudge on your glasses? Your imagination? Or something else entirely? Fortunately, here in Prince George, Claydeley-Tanay, there is someone qualified who can bring clarity to such blurry objects in the sky, and that is Malhar Kendekar, president of the Prince George Astronomical Society, a nonprofit organization that runs an observatory near West Lake. Mr. Kendekar wasn't at the observatory at the time, but he too witnessed this phenomenon and joined us over the line for this not-so-exclusive tell-all tale of a not-so-close encounter of the first kind.
Hello, Malhar speaking.
Hi, Malhar. It's Ian at CIFA Radio. How are you?
So there were lots and lots of reports about people seeing this weird thing in the sky on May 5th in between 10 to 10:30 local time, Pacific time. it was weird because, you know, it appeared kind of a fuzzy, you know, blob or an orb, if you will, traveling across the sky. Well, not, I mean, it was kind of low, about, you know, 10 or even 7 degrees above the horizon. It was coming from southwest and going to south until it kind of disappeared.
Understood.
I was just coming home from walk, and I was just sitting in our living room, and I saw this weird, fuzzy, whitish kind of a glow in the lower horizon. And it was still, I mean, it was during astronomical twilight, which was at about 10:20-ish or so. And at 10:28, that's when I noticed.
In that moment when you noticed this blobbish thing floating through the sky, as someone who looks at the sky quite often as an astronomer yourself, did you think to yourself, oh my goodness, this is not something of this earth?
Good question. You know, I mean, so I've seen the exact same thing in 2025, August 13th.
Okay.
And so it was actually visible, same thing from Prince George.
To you, this was familiar.
This is not the first time which was visible, You know, I mean, when I saw this object, you know, I kind of knew that what it actually was. My wife, she didn't know what it was, and she was asking, oh, what is that? It looks weird. Is it a UFO? because it did, you know, look weird, because we're not used to seeing weird kind of a, you know, whitish blob traveling in our night sky. So this was kind of a weird thing for a lot of people.
Certainly out of the ordinary.
Kind of a weird, like not just in Prince George, but all across, you know, British Columbia, some parts of Alberta, apparently some parts of Saskatchewan too, which I had no idea about. So I was talking to someone and they just told me that they saw it in Saskatchewan. But from Prince George, when I saw that, I immediately, you know, said to my wife that, oh, yes, it's a SpaceX rocket, most likely carrying Starlink satellites. Then I started doing the research and the launch and whatnot of SpaceX launch. And sure enough, it was Falcon 9, which was actually launched from Vandenberg Space Force Base, which is in California, at 8:59 Pacific time or local time. So the Falcon 9 is, of course, that was on May 5th, that was used to actually carry, they were carrying 24 Starlink satellite into our low Earth orbit. Yeah, so that's exactly what we kind of saw that evening. And it was, I mean, it was still, you know, it was just getting dark. Just astronomical twilight is kind of the last light just before we get to dark times. And the reason we kind of saw that blob, or it's also called kind of a jellyfish effect, it was ideal, you could say it was ideal conditions for us to actually see that, you know, glowing blob or an orb or a jellyfish kind of a structure. It actually came from the rocket's exhaust plumes, and they were actually illuminated by the sunlight high above the Earth's atmosphere, even though, you know, it already was kind of dark here on the ground in Prince George. But as the rocket travels higher and higher, then you can actually see the sunlight as well. So meaning almost all the rockets, of course, travel at an extremely high altitude where the atmosphere is extremely thin. So the exhaust, all the gases actually expand outwards, you know, dramatically. And that can create a large translucent cloud around the rocket. And that's what that kind of a orb or kind of a weird form or a shape you can actually see. And since the Falcon 9 that a lot of people actually saw, so it was still pretty high, you know, in the altitude to be actually directly illuminated by the sunlight just after the sunset, because the plumes of the exhaust gases were actually glowing brightly against our Prince George dark skies.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So this event is actually not so rare with the increasing amount of rockets being launched into the atmosphere with satellites and payloads and so on. What's unique is the light conditions or timing of this, where we could actually see that exhaust plume.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Exactly. And, you know, because rocket launches are happening more and more often, I mean, it's cool, really, really, you know, neat to actually look at these rocket launches. But what it's more important at the same time is it's actually impacting astronomy. It's also impacting our night sky. You know, it's because the amount of satellites we have in our low Earth orbit and geosynchronous orbit, it is absolutely mind-boggling. And there are more and more satellites being launched almost every single day. So for professional astronomers like us, it's getting more and more challenging to do science, to do sky surveys. And not just for professional astronomers, but it also affecting stargazers and people who want to do astrophotography, people want to just take a look at the night sky, be out in a dark location. But a lot of times what they're seeing is there are satellites going all across the sky every single second. So it's an incredible sight for public to actually see when the rocket launches and whatnot. But it also kind of reflects a changing night sky that astronomers now have to actually have to work around all these satellites all the time.
I'm thinking of someone trying to research activity on a lake. Maybe they have an aerial view of the lake and they're counting birds, or maybe they're able to peer below the sheen of the surface and see the plant life and the fish. But that lake slowly over time gets more and more and more popular for people putting boats on and boating around. Yep. And eventually it's full of boats to the extent that the birds are scared off and you can't see the bottom of the lake because there's a boat in the way letting you see it. But the way that people tend to populate an area with certain access to technology tends to change things and change the way we do things. Do you see a future where this type of thing calms down and gets more manageable for the type of work that you do? Or what do things look like in that regard?
You know, you gave a really good example about the lake and boats and how it's affecting the fish and all of that, because that's exactly what's happening to our night sky. You know, we talk about, you know, greener Earth. You know, I mean, most people do their part in recycling and all of that for a planet to keep our Earth relatively healthy. But what about the night sky? Once the satellites goes up there, if the satellite, for example, gets, or a space telescope is decommissioned, no one is bringing those satellites or telescopes back down on our planet. They're just staying there and they're orbiting our planet constantly. And it's actually, there is a name for it. It's actually called the Kessler syndrome. So what Kessler syndrome actually says is what will actually happen at one point, humans will put out so many satellites into our low Earth orbit and geosynchronous orbit that it will be actually impossible for humanity to actually do space exploration. And exactly we are heading towards, which is a sad reality, but you can't stop technology, of course, and the solutions to bring all the satellites and all the, we call it as a space debris, you know, bring that down on the planet. It's really challenging. Either it's too expensive or ideas are unrealistic. So there is really no solution yet, but I hope, you know, some space agencies and someone will kind of find some solution and clear the low Earth orbit and the geosynchronous orbit. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of a small reminder for humanity how active the space flight has become over the years, over the century, you know, but also a sign that the night sky is no longer a quiet or untouched place as it was before at one point.
That's definitely food for thought. The night sky or space itself has a humbling effect on many people. It reminds us of how small we really are in the bigger picture of things. And
absolutely.
This effect you refer to, the Kessler effect, where there becomes so much space junk, I guess, that we're actually then unable to do anything off planet because we've kind of painted ourselves into a corner. It sounds like a very big problem. But
that's right.
Are you aware of any activities or actions that people are doing or trying to do to address that, and anything that people local to Prince George can participate in a way to get involved in that activity?
We haven't done anything yet, but we keep advocating, my team and I, to space agencies and to other organizations, as we constantly advocate about